Pope Leo XIV weighs in on the Durbin-Supich controversy here in the U.S. Robert Royal and Father Robert McTague are here with their analysis. Actress Kim Carrath, the original Gretel in The Sound of Music, reflects on the 60th anniversary of the classic film and the brand new stage production at the Kennedy Center. And Daily Wire host Michael Knowles tells me how theater, the classics, and his faith fuels his work. The World Open begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Pope Leo spoke out this week on the controversial decision by Cardinal Blaise Supich of Chicago to honor Dick Durbin, the Illinois senator, with a Lifetime Achievement Award, this despite his decades-long public support of abortion on demand. 10 bishops spoke against the honor. Durbin has since decided to decline it. But Pope Leo's comments, have they brought clarity or confusion to the situation? Here with analysis, I'm joined by editor-in-chief of The Catholic Thing, Robert Royal, and Jesuit theologian and host of the Catholic Current podcast, Father Robert McTague. Thank you for being here. On Tuesday, as you all know, Pope Leo was asked by EWTN News in Rome about this controversy. He started this way.
I'm not terribly familiar with the particular case. I think that it's very important to look at the overall work that a senator has done during, if I'm not mistaken, 40 years of service in the United States Senate. I understand the difficulty and the tensions, but I think, as I myself have spoken in the past, it's important to look at many issues that are related to what is the teaching of the church.
Bob, what is Leo saying here? I mean, isn't this similar to Cardinal Supich's original defense of this award, that there are many issues to consider, not just one, abortion?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that this was kind of a political ducking and dodging. He's from Chicago. He's from Illinois. It's primarily a Democratic state, and he knows it's been a hot-button issue, a hot potato out there for years and years. Unfortunately, he's not following the teaching of the church on this. He's following, rather, what has become kind of a settled understanding among certain people in the church about Democratic politics. The only coherent view of this, in my estimation, came in 2004, when then Cardinal Ratzinger sent a message to the bishops of the United States, which, as we know, Cardinal McCarrick tried to distort, saying that not all issues are on the same moral plane. And obviously, there's a difference between someone who supports the direct killing of innocent human life in the womb and someone who is allegedly good on immigration. I don't even allow that characterization, because we haven't had immigration reform in the last 20, 25 years. So what good Dick Durbin has done in immigration, I don't know, other than to kind of weigh in on the Democratic side and the side of the people in the church who think that enforcing the law is somehow inhuman or unchristian.
Father, I want your reaction to this portion of Leo's comments. Here he is talking about the meaning of the term pro-life.
Someone who says I'm against abortion but says I'm in favor of the death penalty is not really pro-life. So someone who says that I'm against abortion but I'm in agreement with the inhuman treatment of immigrants who are in the United States, I don't know if that's pro-life.
Father McTague, does support for the death penalty or enforcement of immigration law cancel one's pro-life status?
Raymond, if I were granted three wishes from a genie, the first would be that the Pope never gives an off-the-cuff remarks to the press again. And the second would be that we don't expect the Pope to have everything to say about every issue in a 24-hour news cycle. And if we got those granted, I wouldn't want a third wish. I would be happy. The short answer, though, is no. Abortion is an intrinsic evil. There is no way to spin it, negotiate it, talk about it, listen about it. It is always and everywhere wrong. It's part of revelation. It's part of natural law that capital punishment is illicit, but the application is prudential. And to equate a prudential question, which may not be ignored or denied, and then make that on the same level as an intrinsic evil is a category error. I wish that would stop.
Mm. Bob, the Pope claims that there is a complexity of these life issues. Watch.
They're very complex issues. I don't know if anyone has all the truth on them, but I would ask first and foremost that there be greater respect for one another and that we search together, both as human beings, in that case as American citizens or citizens of the state of Illinois, as well as Catholics, to say we need to, you know, really look closely at all of these ethical issues and to find the way forward as church. The church teaching on each one of those issues is very clear.
Bob, are these issues all that complex? I thought the church always taught that the killing of innocent life was wrong and that capital punishment, for instance, for those who take innocent human life is permitted.
Yeah, look, if you listen carefully, what he's trying to do is just calm the waters a bit here, as I said earlier. And if you're going to be sensitive on all these different issues, fine. It's not necessarily complex. His father says it's a category error to make these things seem to be all on the same moral plane. Now, what Cardinal Supich in Chicago has argued is that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans are able to be wholly faithful to the church because of political polarization in the United States. If that's true, what I would argue is then you shouldn't give anybody an award. If you're going to say that even some of those secondary issues are so urgent that if, say, a Republican supports Donald Trump on immigration, he's somehow not pro-life, then okay, don't give a Republican an award, but certainly don't give a Democrat an award who's advocating or at least allowing people to kill innocent human life. There are complexities, but there are also very clear principles at play here, and we should get the hierarchy of the truths and the hierarchy of importance clear in our minds.
Cardinal Supich issued a statement in response to Senator Durbin declining the honor due to this controversy. I want to get your reaction. He says, Senator Durbin today informed me that he has decided not to receive an award at the Keep Hope Alive celebration. I want to make clear that the decision to present him an award was specifically in recognition of his singular contribution to immigration reform and his unwavering support of immigrants, which is so needed in our day. We are not a one-issue church. Father, are we not a one-issue church? And what about the trafficking of human beings and the sexual abuse related to unregulated immigration? I mean, I've been there. I've watched this happen on the Rio Grande.
Look, Raymond, we are a one-issue church, and the one issue is the truth, and that is not negotiable, and it's not really difficult to figure out. Human life is good. Humans are made in the image and likeness of God, deserve to be treated with charity and respect, and we're only as safe as the most vulnerable member of our society. And one of the reasons I think we're having this conversation is because it is socially tolerable to countenance the murder of the unborn, not only in the West, but even among Catholic circles, among Catholics who should really know better. Imagine, Raymond, if Senator Durbin were on the side of the angels on every moral issues, but also espoused clericalism, praying only in Latin, and endorsed racist attitudes that Margaret Sanger would proudly endorse. He wouldn't be getting that reward, would he? So I find the cardinal's objections to be disingenuous.
Bob, the cardinal suggests a remedy at the end of his letter to avoid future controversies. He says, I believe it would be worthwhile to schedule some synodal meetings for members of the faithful to experience listening to each other with respect on these issues, all the while remaining open to maturing more fully in their common identity as Catholics. Bob, synodal gatherings where members of the faithful listen to each other while remaining open to maturing more fully. So listen and get with the program. What do you think that means?
Well, I think what's likely to happen if such meetings are to be organized is what we see in our politics as a whole, because people are shouting at one another over these kinds of issues. This is not simply something that can be talked past. It has to be thought through. That's the only possible resolution to this. For too long, people in the church, for obvious reasons, for obvious political reasons, have been willing to countenance people in the Democratic Party who are Catholic, who are willing to go along with their party over their church on the issue of abortion. So fine, if they want to go with their party and not with the church, then the church should not turn around and then reward them or award them some sort of recognition for what they've been doing. Look around the world, the first cause of death around the world, not just in the United States, around the world is abortion. It's 60 or 70 million abortions take place a year. That kind of slaughter, if it were taking place in any country in the world, even in a war zone, we would be horrified that this has happened. If you really believe that killing an innocent human baby in the womb is murder, then how can you possibly be reaching out, being open, being synodal about that question?
Yeah, well, Bob, I think this is why, and Father, I'll give you very quickly the last word. I think this is why the faithful watching this are so distressed, because you raise the primary issue. You have a politician who has been denied communion in his own diocese for years because of his public stance supporting a gravely evil act that the church vehemently opposes and has always taught is objectively evil. And yet we're now wanting to present him with an award. Father, there's the disconnect, because it shows you either don't really believe that, you don't really think the Eucharist is in need of protecting that much, or that all these issues are kind of, that it's in the old books, but we don't need to talk about that to disturb the unity that we have here. Father McTague, final comment.
I mean, very simply, here's my concern. These exhortations to listening are, again, disingenuous, distracting, and dangerous. What can a pro-abortion advocate say that hasn't already been refuted decades ago by the pro-life movement? I have absolutely no interest in hearing any excuse, however earnestly proposed, that will allow for the murder of children in the womb. And the idea that it's something that honorable people may sit down and talk about and discover some third way of appreciating abortion, I don't want to be part of that. I don't want to be complicit in that sin.
Robert Royal, Father Robert McTague, thank you for being here. I now want to bring in Bill Donahue, president of the Catholic League. Bill, you have been on this Durbin Award controversy for some weeks, but while the bishops and other groups were targeting Cardinal Supich for offering this award to Durbin, you took a different tact. What was it and why?
Well, first of all, I don't like to be oppositional to the clergy. That's something absolutely, I have no other choice. Quite frankly, Durbin's Catholic. The Catholic League is Catholic too, but we're both laymen, okay? If you want to go after cardinals, I don't think that's the best route to go. My problem here, I don't think he should have been awarded the award, that's for sure. But my problem here is with Durbin and with the fact that people have misrepresented this, and therefore I think they hoodwinked the Pope, who said, well, we agree that there's more than just one issue that Catholics have to look at. The fact of the matter is, as I pointed out on a couple of occasions to Durbin, I wrote specifically to him, we sent it an overnight mail, he got it the next morning, no question he received it. It wasn't just abortion. We listed his support for same-sex marriage. We listed his opposition to religious liberty. To be specific, he worked against three different appointees to the federal bench, including two who made it to the Supreme Court, John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett. He subjected them to a religious test, asking them to basically betray their Catholic convictions in order to get a seat on the bench. So it went well beyond that. And it's not just even abortion. When the child is born as a result of a botched abortion, should that child be attended to or just left to die on the physician's table? He said that was okay. So I think if the Holy Father knew exactly the totality of this man's positions on matters of marriage, family, and sexuality, he might have had a different conclusion. But I think it's best for the lay Catholics to go after lay Catholics and let the clergy, which they did a good job. What, 9, 10 different bishops have weighed in on this, and it's difficult. They want to have a certain degree of fraternity, too. But no, we took the right approach. And unfortunately, many in the media are crediting other people for doing it. They don't even know how to do anything right in terms of strategy. I've been doing this stuff for decades. And by the way, we went after Durbin on those religious liberty questions with the judges for the last several decades. Where are all these other people, the Johnny-come-lately? They're juveniles.
Bill, what did you make of, I mean, we had 10 bishops who came out against this honor, and there are reports, the Pillar was reporting, that the USCCB, the entire bishops' conference, was preparing a statement to condemn this honor as well. Why do you think they were so willing to come out and be vocal in this moment? And how do you put into context what the Pope said? I mean, these are clearly confusing remarks, Bill, at the least.
In terms of the USCCB, I don't think they had much choice. After all, they're the ones who passed the protocols. I didn't do it. You didn't do it. It had nothing to do with lay people. It wasn't priests. It was the bishops. I think it was, in 2004, if I'm not mistaken. They put out the protocols. You cannot give an honor to someone who has basically betrayed the moral principles upon which the Catholic Church stands. And obviously, the right to life has to be the premier right of all. So I think that if you allow... If you allow Durbin to get this award, what's next? I might mention that a number of years ago when Obama got an award at Notre Dame, I was on TV with a priest who I'm friends with, but he's on the other side. And I said, look, Father, you and I are both against racism and against abortion. He said, that's right. I said, the difference between you and me is that you wouldn't give an award to a racist, but you will give an award to somebody who's pro-abortion. That's a big difference between the two of us. And I think that needs to be said. If we think that racism is worse than abortion, and it is evil, the church regards racism and abortion to be intrinsically evil, but then we have a problem.
Yep.
The first right is the right to life. In terms of Pope Leo, he says, listen, I'm not familiar with all of the details. They kind of got him when he's coming out of a meeting. He's got the microphones. He didn't prepare a formal statement. I don't know if he knows that people like the Catholic League have been pointing out the religious liberty objections to Durbin and his support for same-sex marriage and the Born Alive Infant Protections Act and everything else and partial birth abortion, not just simply abortion in the first and second trimester. So I have to give the Holy Father the benefit of the doubt, and the media did a lousy job in the way they covered this.
Bill Donahue, we will leave it there. Thank you for being here. We'll check in with you in the days ahead. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you so much.
So long, farewell.
It has been 6 decades since this young lady captured the hearts of moviegoers the world over.
The sun has gone to bed, and so must I.
The classic film version of The Sound of Music is 60 this year, and my next guest, as you saw there, was just 6 years old when she played Gretel von Trapp alongside Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer in the classic film. Well, she's in Washington, D.C. to help kick off the national touring production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music at the Kennedy Center. She joined me in D.C. recently. Here's my exclusive interview with Kim Carruth.
The hills are alive with the sound of music, with songs they have sung for 1,000 years.
Kim, I cannot believe it has been 65 years since Sound of Music premiered, the musical, and then 60 years since you all did the film all those years ago. But that wasn't your first movie.
No, it was actually my fourth movie. I started when I was 3 years old.
Wow. And you were discovered where?
At my father's restaurant. My father was in the restaurant business. And as the story goes, because I don't remember that particular episode, they came up to me and my mother and said to my mother, your daughter's so adorable. Would you like to have her in a movie? And my mother said, you should just ask her. So they asked me, and I said, well, if it doesn't take too long, because I have a lot of dolls to take care of.
Oh, and they so they gave you doll, they gave you doll release, and you said, yes, I'll do
it. Yeah, exactly.
Wow, you know? And what a permit. I mean, Spencer's Mountain with Henry Fonda and Maureen O'Sullivan. That
Maureen
had to be,
O'Hara,
O'Hara.
Exactly.
That had to be incredible. And then you're in movies
then
with
the
Doris Day.
Then The Thrill of It All with Doris Day.
Yeah, and Jack Lemmon
and
after
Jack
that.
Lemmon. Mm-hmm.
I mean, an incredible. So then how did The Sound of Music come into your life? Did you audition for the role?
I did. All that experience was, you know, I mean, there were lots of kids with experience.
Yeah.
And we all just auditioned.
For Robert Wise. What did you sing?
Earnestly.
Do you remember?
Well, I do remember, actually, because first of all was the regular audition. There were a couple of those. Then there was the singing audition as you cleared everything else.
Uh-huh.
And apparently they asked me, could you sing a song? I said, which one? I know all of them. Because
from the musical.
I did.
You would listen to it.
I'd listen to it, yeah. Because basically I knew everything at that particular age. I had a great memory, and like put music on, I would just be.
You still have a great memory. We were talking before the show, and you remembered eating Ponchatoula strawberries in New Orleans.
That's very, very memorable.
That's very specific, Kim.
Very. So I decided to sing 16 going on 17. Why? Because I was 5 going on like 17 pretty much at that point. Thanks to my older brother and sister. So I always wanted to be.
Were they musical?
Everybody was musical.
The whole family.
My whole family was The Sound of Music.
You're kidding.
My mother had a beautiful coloratura soprano voice.
Wow.
She had sung once at Carnegie Hall. My family was Greek.
Yeah.
And
Aurelia.
Avrilia in Greek.
Beautiful name.
Yeah. Born on the island of Lesbos and came to America when she was 8 years old.
Wow.
And Daddy was born in New York, but then actually raised in Greece. So I had very, very, my grandparents didn't speak a word of English. So I did learn Greek. I had to go to Greek school, and yeah.
Wow.
So, but I would answer I'm a Californian when anybody asked me anything, but you know, I feel the roots of it.
So 5 years old, you get swept off to Austria to shoot for what, 6 months?
Well, 3 months in Austria, but the whole shoot was a whole year altogether.
Oh.
So 3 months, and then post 3 months in Los Angeles at the studio, 3 months in Salzburg. Should have been 6 weeks, but it rained all the time.
Oh my gosh.
So and then 3 months of looping and like all the things you do. It was time consuming, but it gave me a chance to become family with my Sound of Music siblings.
Wow. That continues to this day. You're still close to all of them.
To this day. People always find it so entertaining to hear and so funny and nice, but we just became part of one another's lives.
I read an interview with you where you said, again, a 5-year-old, one of the best things about the movie to me was becoming a family.
Yeah, it really was. It's sustained me through my entire life. Heather Menzies, who passed away, I was at her bedside when she got sick, and with Charmian as well. I just love them so much, and we miss them. Every time that 5 of us are together, we miss them.
Wow.
Heather and her husband, Robert, were godparents to my son, Eric.
Unbelievable.
So our lives have, you know,
merged. It really was a lifelong bond out of that
lifelong
movie. Tell me about Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer. Your greatest memory of working with both of them?
You know, my greatest memories are not really working with them because they were later. The greatest memories were later. So here's my favorite Chris Plummer story. So I hadn't seen him in many years, and somebody invited me to go to the Westport Country Playhouse. He lived in Westport, Connecticut. Yeah. After 9/11, there was a fundraiser for the firefighters. Paul Newman was in it, a lot of other celebrities, and somebody had me go backstage, and Paul Newman knew and was waiting for me and said, threw his arms around me and said, your father's been pacing the floor waiting to see you. So I went into his dressing room, and he threw his arms around me, and so happy to see him. He was just wonderful.
Uh-huh.
And so that was one of my favorite memories was Paul Newman and Chris Plummer.
And Chris Plummer in the same location.
Yeah,
pretty
exactly.
incredible.
Pretty incredible.
What about Julie Andrews? What was she like off screen?
Julie is as wonderful off screen as she is on screen. That's all I can say. There's like, she's sweet and funny and warm and maternal. And, you know, if you're around her and she thinks it's cold, she'd be like, do you have a sweater with you? She's just a mom in that lovely way. At the same time, so sophisticated. And just kind of everything you see is what you get with Julie.
I read where she would sing to you all between takes.
She did.
And with you all.
She was just our friend on the set.
All these years later, I mean, you must look back on this. I mean, Julie Andrews said this really was the last great Hollywood film. Do you feel that way?
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't really think of it on a historical level so much because, I don't know, I just don't.
You were part of it. Yeah.
I certainly think it's one of the last great musicals.
Without a doubt. And its sustaining power. What do you think has driven it all these years? I mean, look, I can remember not so many years ago, it happens annually, taking my kids to Wolf Trap outdoors here in Virginia, and they play the movie and have a sing-along. And you've got children singing with their great-grandparents. I mean, it's an incredible... There are a few things in the culture, and I love when these happen and I try to point them out to the audience. There are a few things that draw generations together, like this film has.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, whenever I'm asked something similar, I mean, I think it's sort of a combination of many different things. I think the music is absolute genius. Rodgers and Hammerstein at their best. Soaring melodies, beautifully done. Julie Andrews' voice, the incredible Salzburg setting and what they were able to create on the studio, which was on the studio lot, which was true artistry.
That will bring us back to dough. Oh, oh, oh.
Dough!
A deer, a female deer.
Ray!
A drop of golden sun.
But also this incredible story that is a true story.
Yeah.
And that, I think that grounds it in something that ultimately I think is profound, because it's about a family, and it's about a family in circumstances that are about to become quite extreme, who make a very, very significant moral choice.
Did you meet the Von Trapps?
Yes.
And I know you know them now.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Wow. What an incredible honor. And I'll tell you one of my most emotional Von Trapp story. So in 1999, there was a Broadway revival of The Sound of Music.
Oh, I remember that.
And we were all invited to go, so flew to New York to do that. And actually, I think I was living in Connecticut at the time, so drove in. And the Von Trapps were there. And Austria, the Office of Tourism, I think, was doing a little soiree for us before. And so they asked us to sing Silent Night all together. So the Broadway cast, all seven of us, and the actual Von Trapp sang Silent Night. And it still kind of chokes me up, because it was like, I mean, I still have goosebumps thinking about it.
Yeah.
It was kind of amazing. I don't think anybody recorded it, but I mean, to have their history with us that day.
Incredible.
Was just amazing.
Yeah, no, it's really the meeting of both the cultural and the reality. And what a moment.
Oh, absolutely.
What a moment.
Yeah.
Tell me, in 1991, you have a birth. Your son Eric comes into the world, and this really changed your life in an unexpected way. Tell me what happened.
Well, everything was perfect and wonderful and everything, and then he contracted viral meningitis when he was 3 weeks old. And then he had seizures and almost didn't make it. And so it created brain damage. He's in wonderful shape. He's strong and gorgeous and sweet as can be. But we live with disability.
Yeah. And you started a foundation as a result of...
Well, he changed, as I told you, the entire trajectory, and struggling to get the right set of circumstances for him, you know, in terms of school, in terms of everything, was very difficult.
Yeah.
And I met a woman who I think is a human angel, who was Eric's teacher at Malibu High School when we moved back to California. Mm. Her name, I will say her name because it is a name of an angel, Lisa Zalagi. And she loved all the kids in that class so much. And after the kids started to age out, all of us parents and Lisa, it was Lisa's dream to create a program after like the age of 22, when they were no longer serviced by the school system.
Yeah.
And we looked around because we didn't necessarily want to create something from scratch if there was something great, but there wasn't.
There was nothing.
And so we created a program, and we're in our 12th year, and we serve close to 100 young adults with disabilities.
Wow, incredible. I love that family runs through your whole life. From the time you were a child, your parents, this Sound of Music family that continues with you to this day. And here you are in Washington going to the Kennedy Center to see a new revival of Sound of Music 60 years after you did the movie, 65 years after the premiere of the musical. What happens to you when you hear these songs?
Well, first of all, let me just say, I'm so thrilled. Yeah. I've never been to the Kennedy Center before.
First time.
And I have just an awe of the Kennedy Center. Mm-hmm. And it's even bigger this year because last Christmas, here's my little Christmas story. So my son loves Christmas. So I'm just like my father. I put Christmas songs on right after Thanksgiving.
Me too. If not before Thanksgiving. My wife always says, can we at least wait till the turkey's cut?
The household is like, can you just please wait till Thanksgiving at least? I'm right with you on that one. And so we started, and then we watch every Christmas special you can possibly watch on TV. I mean, honestly, Christmas starts, and Eric is so happy. And finally, we ran out of things this year, and I'm like, okay, we need some fresh material here. And YouTube has every single Kennedy Center Christmas from, I don't know, Reagan.
Yeah.
And I've watched all the presidents celebrate Christmas. We've watched with Eric, like, all of these incredible musicians, everyone from Johnny Mathis to, I mean, just everyone, Julie Andrews and Johnny Mathis. And it's... So I've been even more in awe of the Kennedy Center. I mean, I always was with the Kennedy Center Honors, but it's just like it's a cornerstone of our culture.
Yeah, I agree. It's our cultural showplace. I mean, it's America's showplace. So your thoughts on this revival, a new generation seeing this show live. It was written, Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote this very late in their careers, and still, I mean, usually songwriters at the end, not so hot. Not these guys.
Oh, yeah, not them. Not them.
Every song's a hit.
Top of their game.
It's incredible.
Yeah,
and I guess Edelweiss was the last lyric that Oscar Hammerstein wrote.
That's what I heard, yeah.
But what do you feel when you sit there and you hear these songs?
Oh, I'm going to try to not cry. That's going to be my major... I'm gonna be overwhelmed, and I'm going to try to not cry, mostly, because it's overwhelming, it's touching, it connects me to... You know, my family, my cast family, my son, like just everything. It's and the world, because Sound of Music's been a little bit of an international passport, tell you the truth.
Well, and it's also a great touchstone of the American musical, the American family, and the values that hold us up and sustain us through time. Every time I see it, that always comes rushing back. And those beautiful melodies. I mean, nobody wrote melodies like Richard Rodgers.
No. So I have to completely agree with you.
Well, Kim, what a joy. Enjoy the show. And so long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen. Goodbye. Great to see you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Into bed and so must I.
So long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen. Goodbye.
And The Sound of Music is playing at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. through October 5th. Then it resumes its national tour. For more information and tickets to the remaining Kennedy Center performances, go to kennedy-center.org. Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with actor David Henry this week. David and I talked about his relationship with Selena Gomez and her new husband, a new season of Wizards Beyond Waverly Place, and how marriage and family gave his life purpose. Watch. How has being a dad and a husband changed, shifted, deepened the work you're doing or the work you're called to do?
You know, it's everything. Like, I meet a lot of young people that are like, I have to wait to a certain point to be able to have kids. The opposite was true for me. Yeah. Like, the second I started having kids, it's like my brain... I don't know, nature, adaptation, I don't know what it is. Like, the second I started having kids, my brain shifted gears.
Yeah.
And I got so much more focused, so much more precise, so much more intentional. Mm. It made me question myself. Who am I? What do I stand for? What do I want my kids to look up to? What am I going to pass down to them? What am I going to achieve? Like, it all kind of clicked in my mind, and I got this fire under me.
Well, it turns you into a man.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. And you rise to the occasion.
Yeah.
You will rise to the occasion. Like, the time to have kids is now.
Yeah.
Like, do it now. Don't wait.
Yeah.
Like, waiting is the you will never be ready. You will never be ready. You'll never have enough money. You'll never be ready. It just do it.
I do, like, know some guys who waited and waited and waited. They're like 60 on the second wife, and now they've got the children. Now they're too old to, they can't get out of the chair.
I literally just got a call from a buddy on set who goes, so after our talk, my wife got pregnant. We're gonna do this now. Because I told him, I was like, he's like 28 or 29. Yeah. I go, you have a finite amount of energy, my friend.
Yes.
I'm 35 now. And when I was 27, when we had our first kid, even to now, my energy level is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
You only have so much. God built us this way. He didn't build us to have kids in our 50s and 60s.
No.
Like, he built us to have kids at an early age because you have a finite amount of energy and you want to spend that energy with those kids.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with David Henry is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an Arroyo Grande Show. It's absolutely free. And Friday's Prayerful Posse examines Pope Leo's pro-life comments in real depth. Visit RaymondArroyo.com for all the links. And while you're there, I'm going on a cruise in the footsteps of St. Paul and St. John. I'd love to have you join us. In September of 2026, we're going to Thessalonica and Patmos, Athens, Ephesus, to the Virgin Mary's house. There'll be daily mass with Monsignor Christopher Nolte. It's going to be an inspiring trip, and gosh knows we need it. All the details are at RaymondArroyo.com. Space is limited, so sign up quickly. And finally, he's a Yale grad, political commentator and former actor and current Daily Wire host. He's become one of the most popular conservative voices in media today. He's also a devoted traditional Catholic. I sat down with him in Nashville earlier this year to discuss how his origins and his faith influence his work. Here's my interview with Michael Knowles. At 7 years old, you start in the drawn to the theater.
Yes.
Why?
To what my great it? Shame, though I think you can empathize with me.
I completely empathize. Yes.
My whole life, I knew that I wanted to be in politics and in show business. I don't know how. Before even my earliest memories, that's just what I wanted.
Did you go to the theater as a kid? Somebody take you?
I did. I would go. I grew up in New York, so I would go see Broadway or different, you know, shows, regional, and I really enjoyed it. But both of those things were in my head from an early age. In fact, I knew since I was a little kid I wanted to go to Yale because I felt Yale was the only place you could go and be in politics or in show business.
Or in the arts.
You know, in the arts. It did both. And so I was always quite drawn to that. And I think many people will hear that and say, well, okay, politicians and actors have a lot in common. They're liars. They're egotistical. They're very vain.
But they shouldn't.
But they shouldn't, because at their best, acting is not lying. It's telling the truth in imaginary circumstances.
Yes.
And at their best, actors and politicians are... care about people. They care about character. They care about what makes human beings tick. They care about human nature.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're bad versions of both of those things. But at their best, I think they have a lot in common, which is why you see a lot of Ronald Reagan's, Arnold Schwarzenegger's, Donald Trump's, for that matter.
Yeah. Yes. Well, the showbiz is a part of connecting with people. And if you use it for good,
yes,
there's a power there. Tell me about, I saw in your biography, the Stella Adler Conservatory, where you studied as a very young person.
Yes, I was an early teenager, and I studied there. But Stella Adler was gone at this
point. Yes, yeah.
And I believe you studied with the woman herself.
Yeah, my old mentor, and torturer.
Yeah,
Yes. For 3 years, I was in her last class. I think I'm the reason she had the last class, but we definitely put her away. She was a great, I mean, for those who don't, Stella Adler was kind of one of the apostles of...
Yes.
Acting technique in America.
Yes.
And look, I was, the time I was studying in New York, Michael, it was at amazing. I studied, you're going to really be envious of this. I studied personally with Sandy Meisner, Uta Hagen, Stella Adler. Beatrice Straight was a dear friend of mine who did network, won an Academy Award for network, and taught the Chekhov technique. So
to be there at that moment and see, I mean, I really did feel like a disciple to these people.
It's unbelievable because my teacher, after the Stella Adler School, she was gone. I went back for a professional scene study with Wynn Handman, he was an assistant to Meisner in the 50s. And what's funny about all these people you're naming, though, the members of the group theater, Wynn later, they were all basically commies or socialists.
At one point. Stella left, but some stayed for a long time.
Yes, and I thought it's very funny to be a conservative, but to have been trained by these people, you know, disciples of Shaw and all of these radical left people. But I think of that training in many ways as being similar to going to a very left-wing university, which is if you can maintain your beliefs, your core of beliefs, it's really very helpful because it exposes you. There is not a left-wing thought that has not been presented to me, that I haven't had to consider. That's just the mainstream of the culture. And so if you can swim against the tide a little bit, you get all of the benefits of their teaching, and you also can figure out where they go a little wrong.
Then you go off to Yale. You study history, Michael. What happened to the theater? Now, I know you continue doing
lots of
theater
plays
there.
And
you were directing plays and operas.
Yes, yeah. I was very involved, but I was not, they didn't have a performance major.
Uh-huh.
Had they had a performance, you know, the graduate school had the Yale School of Drama has the performance. But undergraduate is basically a dramaturgy degree, and I didn't want that. However, I studied history and Italian literature was my double major, and my two dissertations both involved the theater. My history dissertation was about Lloyd Richards and August Wilson, because they were both at Yale at the same time, and August Wilson had his cycle of Ma Rainey and all that.
Yeah,
Fences just became a movie with Denzel Washington, another Wynn Handman student.
And then how does politics come in? So you graduate, you're working as an actor a little bit, and then there's a congresswoman in 2010.
The great Nan Hayworth.
The great Nan Hayworth. Yeah. And you become her spokesman? What happened there?
Yes. So I had known Nan as a family friend since I was a kid. And Nan was running for Congress, actually while I was still in college.
Ah.
And something about Yale that you might have picked up from this is you do everything but study there. So you do all sorts of extracurriculars, probably a little too much partying, and all these extracurricular activities. So I jumped on Nan's campaign. I started out as an intern, but on a congressional campaign, those campaigns are infamously short on cash, short on staff. It's a great political training ground because you get on-the-ground kind of nitty-gritty politics, but the issues are all federal issues, so you get national exposure. And if you have any ambition, you can rise up a campaign quickly. Yeah. So I took on a more prominent role in the campaign. We were running against a guy named John Hall, who was an incumbent. He was in the band Orleans.
Oh,
you're still the one that all that. So one of their famous songs was "Dance with Me, I Want to Be Your Partner, Can't You See?" So we did a version, the Young Voters, for an Orleans reunion tour. That was Vote With Me, Let's Make John Hall Leave Washington, D.C. And it got a little play, mostly because they threatened to sue us. So after that, Nan won, happily. After that, I was brought into a number of other campaigns. Mm-hmm. I really liked it. So when I was a jobbing actor in New York, doing a little bit of theater, a little bit of TV, a little bit of film, my day job, most day jobs for working actors are catering, waiting tables. Mine was working Republican campaigns. Which led to one of the craziest experiences. I auditioned for a role in New York, and they said, "Do you speak any other languages?" And I said, "Well, I have Italian, touch of French." And I joked. I said, "Oh, and I have Esperanto." I'd studied it a little bit in high school. And I said, "That probably won't be very useful." And they said, "No, actually, it will." The other casting director says, "Will it?" I says, "Yes, client number one speaks Esperanto." I said, "Your client's George Soros." She said, "He is. How'd you know that?" I said, "Because there are about five people on earth who speak Esperanto, and he's the biggest one.
Wow.
He's the only one with the money to cast something." They were casting actors to play sommelier and caterers at his wedding, his third wedding. And they cast me. Oh. And I said, "This is the craziest thing. I've worked Republican campaigns at this point for years." There were people there, you know, Nancy Pelosi, Samantha Power, Bono was there, all these big liberal figures. And it actually gave me some comfort. Because I said, the fact that they hired me to do this job, they could have Googled me. Yes. I said, perhaps George Soros doesn't actually control the whole world.
In the way we imagine.
That's right.
It's a little more limited, just the Upper West Side.
Exactly.
It's okay, but it's good real estate.
Yes.
It's amazing. So you go, tell me about this, though. I'm going to fast forward a little bit here. Yeah. Andrew Klavan has a show.
Yeah. Even before he had a show.
Before you were friends with his son, or worked with his son Spencer, right?
Yes, I was in college. I directed him in opera. We lived in the same dorm.
Is that how you met Andrew?
Yes, and I was a fan of Andrew, and I knew Spencer. I was friends with Spencer.
Yeah.
And somehow I didn't put the two together. Klavan's not a very popular last name, yeah. But I didn't put it together. He calls me up one day. He says, "Michael, my father wants a little help with his communications. Could you help out? You're the only guy I know in conservative politics and show business." I said, "Sure, okay." And so we met and became fast friends. Mm. And it's all kind of providential, I guess. I was planning to move to L.A., do more film work or TV work. Drew was moving down from Santa Barbara to L.A. We were going to move there around the same time. Mm. So I was working with him. That was another one of my day jobs. I had to write like him. I had to learn to write like him for, you know, social media and things like that. And so we end up there. There was a group out there at the time called the Friends of Abe, a secret society, so secret it had a Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
You know, very...
and regular postings in the L.A. Times.
Exactly.
But yes.
Yeah. So I was part of that group, you know, conservatives and show business. And the head of the group at the time was Jeremy Boring. They were putting together first a group called Truth Social, which became the Daily Wire. And I was banging around there. But when Jeremy asked me to join the Daily Wire, I was going to be the pizza boy number three or something of the Daily Wire. There were five employees. He said, "Do you want the job?" And so I said, "Okay, that's fine." We do it. The election day, 2016, I was rapping. It was the last day of principal photography on a very low-budget movie, but that one that I had the lead role in. And I really felt like the dog that caught the car. You know, here, this is great. I'm in L.A. I get to make this movie, albeit with a low budget. And I drove back to the Daily Wire. We did election coverage that night. And I did find something odd, which was when I was on set, when I was actually on the happy occasions I was working as an actor, I was thinking about, boy, wouldn't it be fun to be at the Daily Wire in politics? I was thinking about my day job.
How did that transition work for you? I mean, because it's one thing to work on other people's shows. It's one thing to be a guest on a show. When you're carrying the freight, it's hard.
I was really pleased, in retrospect,
that
I did not get my show until I was I 27? So I was still pretty young.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm glad I didn't get a show at 22. I'm really glad I didn't get a show at 18. A lot of kids these days, because the barrier to entry is even lower than it was when I started.
Yeah. What role does faith play in all this? I know you fell away from your faith for a time.
Yeah.
We all have that experience. What brought you back?
I fell away at 13. I fell away at my confirmation.
Oh.
This was 2003. So this was the church scandals, the new atheists, you know, Christopher Hitchens and all those seducers who were Sam Harris and them. Yeah. Their message was perfectly tailored for a punk 13-year-old boy who thought he was smarter than he was.
Right, with somebody who's smart and read. If you read, they're convincing on the page.
They're convincing. They're good prose writers. Mm-hmm. But they're probably not as convincing for a 23-year-old who reads, or a 33-year-old, but for a 13-year-old they got him. And so I had just the right amount of hubris. There was scandal in the church. Mm-hmm. I had some wonderful catechism teachers personally, but catechesis broadly in the 1990s was very, very weak. And I would say the reforms that followed the Second Vatican Council did not achieve liturgically, I think, what they were trying
to achieve.
You know, I'm trying to be diplomatic.
Liturgically?
About
seminarians, baptisms, marriages, confirmations, confession. I could go on.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
It's all kind of a nosedive.
I remember when I was convinced that God exists because a friend of mine who was cradle Catholic, grew up megachurch Protestant, fell away from the faith around the same time I did. Now he's reverted to the Catholic Church. He and I kind of did it together.
Many years ago, my wife was not Catholic and had bad, she's had a, heard, read and absorbed all the propaganda about the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Whore Babylon.
Right.
They worship saints and plaster saints and they're crazy people and why Mary, all of that. And I took her to Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, where Cardinal O'Connor at the time was holding forth, and he was impressive. And the power of his faith and his oratory cut through, but
It didn't seal the deal. It wasn't until I took her to the Latin Mass in Washington, D.C., Old St. Mary's, which no longer has the Latin Mass.
As I recently learned this past weekend, in fact, when I tried to go.
Oh, yeah. It's gone.
Yeah.
And this was a bastion. In fact, the Mass never stopped there. But it stopped now. Why, before we talk about that, which I do want to talk about, what is it, do you think, drawing young people to the Latin Mass at a time when Rome seems determined to stamp it out?
It should not be surprising that the Mass, which formed statistically all of the saints ever, just about, would have some pull on people. It is a beautiful liturgy. And in the deformations that followed, perhaps for good intentions, but that followed the Second Vatican Council, so much beauty was ripped away for really weak reasoning. You know, the iconoclasm that destroyed so many churches after the council, after the reforms that followed the council, because we have to distinguish between the council and
and what happened afterwards.
Yes. I'm 18 or 19, I'm in Italy for a summer abroad. And I said, well, look, I'm not faithful anymore, but I'll go to the Vatican. I want to see a Latin Mass. Or I want to see a Mass.
A Mass.
This is after the motu proprio from Pope Benedict XVI. And the Latin Mass kicks in. And I had never experienced anything like this before.
Oh, you'd never been before?
No, I didn't know what it was.
Wow.
I knew the church used to speak in Latin in the old-timey days.
Yeah.
That's all I knew.
Yeah.
I went up. I was not in a state of grace. It didn't even occur to me to go to confession. Mm. I went up to receive our Lord in the Eucharist, and I'm standing there with my hands. I was taught in catechism.
Yeah, this is the way they taught. This is how you do it. Receive. Yeah.
It was a man with a red hat, so it was a pretty serious fellow there who was
cardinal.
Who was a cardinal who was administering the Holy Communion, and he didn't move. Waiting. I said, "Am I doing something?" It's been a while, I guess. Yeah. And I went to ask him what I was doing wrong, and he placed the Eucharist on my tongue. Okay. And so I said, wow, that was odd. I wonder why. Oh, okay. Uh-huh. I put it out of my head. At this point, though, you can find the traditional Latin Mass. I noticed it in New York, here and there. And even in the Novus Ordo, you know, wonderful, my old parish, Church of St. Michael in New York, there was a wonderful, very reverent
Novus Ordo.
Novus Ordo.
With Latin, a lot of the Latin. Way it was envisioned, the way the council envisioned it.
Yes.
It wasn't to stamp out Latin or remove chant.
Yes.
It was to bring a little more vernacular into the Mass.
Right. Which
became a runaway train.
Why are the young people drawn to the traditional Latin Mass? Because we want truth. We've grown up in an age in which we were taught from diapers that there is no truth. Or if there is a truth, we can't really know anything about it.
I am always amazed when I travel, no matter where I travel. The Latin Mass, it's never in the glitziest, big, beautiful, you know, places.
No.
It's in little chapels. Now it's, of course, it's practically underground.
Yes.
It's practically underground. But packed with people and screaming babies and women and their children. It's a beautiful sight. It's the future of the church. It's the family.
It is the future of the church. It literally is.
Yeah.
In my traditional Latin Mass parish, the median age is about 8 because of all the kids.
I've been to that parish. I know.
And it's a small, you know, people crawling over each other practically. Even if you took the kids out, though, probably the median age would be about 30.
Yeah, very young.
Maybe. You know, it's... Yeah. And so I find I travel a lot. And I will go to Novus Ordo Masses when I travel sometimes. And I can't help but notice that the median age in those Masses is about 102.
Yeah.
And the median age in the traditional Latin Mass, the supposedly stodgy Mass pushing the youth away, is much, much younger. And so it's above my pay grade, of course, to question the cardinals or the bishops. But when I hear bishops inveigh against the traditional liturgy or discourage even reverent practices in the liturgy because they want to bring the youth back into the pews, I think, you know, I actually have a little bit of experience as a youth, and it would seem to me that if you really wanted to bring some aggiornamento to the church in the spirit of accompaniment, in the spirit even of synodality, perhaps, perhaps we ought to listen to what the laity want, and what the laity want is tradition and reverence and beauty.
In their determination to stamp out, stop, outlaw, ban what is a beautiful, holy expression of worship of God. Why would you ever want to stop that?
Well, there's something fitting about the traditional liturgies being driven underground by these very bishops. You know, I think of Henry VIII. When he goes in, destroys Canterbury Cathedral, tears down such beautiful icons, steals all the land. So the Protestants got all the good churches, yeah. and the Catholics went underground. Yeah. And the deformations that occurred to the liturgy after the Second Vatican Council, in many ways, the purpose was to make the Mass more Protestant, and that was supposed to bring people into the church, even though it didn't work. Yeah. And so once again, we have these Protestant rites, or seemingly Protestant rites, cropping up, and once again, the Mass of the Ages is driven underground. But it is in that struggle, it is in that oppression, yeah. to use a popular word,
yeah.
that often the church flourishes. You know, this is why we say, and the cardinals know this well, they wear the colored slippers, mm-hmm. that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church.
What is the role of the Michael Knowles Show going forward in this time? How do you see it? Will it shift at all? Will it change at all?
It will not change, but it will become, I hope, more of what it is. I hope that it deepens. And part of that is, going back to our friend Aristotle, it's not enough to just understand the virtues. You have to live the virtues. And I think this applies in political philosophy as well.
Yeah.
We move in time and space.
Michael Knowles, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Save me a cigar next time.
I certainly will.
That is all the time we have for now. Until next time, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.